Well, good morning. In the Roman Empire, around the time of the New Testament, the punishment someone might receive for a serious crime would likely depend on their social status. If someone was a friend of the Emperor Caesar, they would likely get off scot-free. But for anyone who was not a Roman citizen, there was a significant risk of being nailed to a cross. Now, crucifixion was designed to combine prolonged extreme pain with maximum public humiliation. It's hard to imagine a more powerful way of deterring people from crime. As a warning, the nature of the offence was written in a notice displayed at the top of the cross. It might say, bandit or murderer or rebel against the emperor. But when it came to Jesus' crucifixion, Pilate, the Roman in charge of the province of Judea, very deliberately chose the words written in capital letters, the King of the Jews. But why choose these words? Well, the gospel records suggest to me that Pilate had three reasons for writing the King of the Jews. Firstly, the Roman Empire was not tolerant of any threat to its authority. Unlike Herod, who ruled Galilee with the permission of Rome, Jesus was not an authorized leader and was therefore a potential threat. Rebels might gather around him. Perhaps Pilate's spies had told him that after the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, the crowd had wanted to make Jesus a king. Now, in the Gospels, it's clear that Pilate did not himself believe that Jesus was a threat to Roman rule. But it was on these grounds that the Jewish leaders finally persuaded Pilate to have Jesus crucified. They called out, "Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." And so by crucifying the King of the Jews, the Roman Empire was saying, the emperor is sovereign, and the empire will deal ruthlessly with anyone who challenges his authority. But it seems to me that Pilate also had a more personal motivation. He was supposed to be the one in charge, and yet he was outsmarted by the Jewish leaders. They got the crucifixion they wanted and forced Pilate to abandon his plan to set Jesus free. So he had been publicly embarrassed. Now again in John's Gospel, we learn that many Jews read the notice on the cross, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." This had immense significance. The King of the Jews was their long-awaited Messiah. He would be the chosen one, the Christ of God, the anointed King, the ultimate fulfillment of the prophecies in the Jewish scriptures, and the focus of the nation's hope for liberation, not least from Roman rule. So the chief priests are appalled by the implication that when the Romans crucified Jesus, they were destroying both the central hope of the Jewish religion and a key part of their national identity. They were desperate to have the notice on the cross changed. They protested to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be the King of the Jews." But Pilate answered, What I have written, I have written. You can almost hear the contempt in his voice. He effectively tells them, I am the judge. My judgment is that Jesus is indeed your king. And it wasn't me who wanted him crucified. It was you. Thus the notice, the king of the Jews, was in effect a very public statement that the Jewish leaders had killed their own Messiah. So Pilate used Jesus to get his own back on the Jewish leaders. And sadly, since then, he has not been alone in using Jesus to put others down. For in history, when societies have been predominantly Christian, at least in name, Christian culture has been used as a way of establishing the power of people who are culturally Christian at the expense of others, not least of Jewish people. So let us be careful not to use Jesus to serve our own selfish purposes, as Pilate did. But there may be a third reason for Pilate declaring Jesus to be the king of the Jews. In John's Gospel, chapter 18, verse 36, Jesus says to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." And Pilate replies, "You are a king then." And Jesus answers, "You're right in saying I'm a king. In fact, for this reason, I was born. And for this, I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." This makes Pilate feel very uncomfortable. Instead of Pilate having authority over Jesus, Jesus calmly implies the opposite. So Pilate tries to deflect Jesus' penetrating words with a cynical reply, "What is truth?" And then to stop himself hearing any more challenging words, he leaves Jesus and goes back outside to the crowd, saying, "I find no basis of a charge against him." So for Pilate, the title "The King of the Jews" is safe. For Pilate is not a Jew, so Jesus cannot be his king. Jesus is a king, yes, but of other people, not of him. But this safe conclusion is threatened by Jesus saying, "My kingdom is not of this world." Or to use the original Greek word, it is not of this cosmos. In other words, Jesus' kingdom is not limited by geography or nationality or time. It has no limits. And then Pilate is even more unnerved when the Jewish leaders insist, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." Jesus? The Son of God? Could that be true? And Pilate is frightened when he realizes he has no evidence that the claim is not true. And if Jesus is the Son of God, he would certainly have authority over Pilate. And so Pilate latches on to the title, "The King of the Jews." It's a title that shows respect, but Jesus' authority is limited to being over other people. Yes, The King of the Jews is a nice, tidy description of a safe Jesus who Pilate can cope with. Jesus' claims about himself are ignored. And isn't this just how our culture today deals with the challenge of Jesus? Imagine asking people you pass in the street, "Who is Jesus?" They might reply, "Oh, Jesus was the baby born at Christmas." Or, "Jesus was a good teacher." Or, "He was a caring healer." Or, "He was a sincere moral teacher." Now, all these answers are respectful and true, but they are also just too safe. Just like Pilate, people today like to keep Jesus at a manageable distance. Now, if as Christians we believe in our minds that Jesus is the Son of God and the King of the kingdom with no limits, then has this transformed our hearts? What is the impact on our motivations, our priorities, our attitudes, and our choices? How much can we say, "Yes, Jesus is indeed my King"? Is it our goal to serve Jesus or ourselves? Are we investing our time, money, and energy in our own petty kingdoms, which won't last? Or do we ask him each day to be king over every part of our lives? But there may be someone present today who would say, "Well, to be honest, I don't believe that Jesus is my king. In fact, I'm not even sure that after he was crucified, he came back to life. Why should I trust the Bible? Hasn't science disproved miracles? Anyway, don't all religions lead to God? Also, I've met some Christians who are hypocrites and bigots. Surely it's better to simply be sincere. And then, how could a loving God allow suffering? You see, I'm put off by all these unanswered questions." Well, of course, many people have very genuine questions. And perhaps in this life, some questions can only be partially answered. But as the preacher in a story once said to someone, "If all your questions could be fully answered, would you then become a Christian?" After a pause, there was an honest but telling reply, "Well, no, I wouldn't." So, will you be like Pilate and avoid the challenge of Jesus? Or will you take a path that leads you to a spiritual encounter with Jesus? There are many aspects of Jesus' teaching and life that can help us on a journey to understanding. But we only reach the essential destination when we meet Jesus at the cross. There he hangs. People mock him. "Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." "He saved others, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we'll believe in him." But King Jesus chooses to suffer, chooses to die. Why? Why? Let's consider this question. In the Bible, we learn that in the beginning, God's plan was that we, the humans he created, would live in a beautiful relationship with him. But due to our selfishness and pride, we've all of us rejected that relationship with God. The Bible calls this sin. And so between us and a holy God, there is a huge gap, a chasm. We may try to build bridges across the gap to reach God, but the gap is too wide. We may try to build bridges of good deeds or religious activity, but our efforts are never completely pure. There will always be a bit of self-interest or pride, and we will remain deserving of the punishment for our rebellion against God. We cannot bridge the gap between us and God. Only God can do that. And so God himself came into our world in the person of Jesus. And the love of Jesus is so powerful that he chose death on the cross in order to take the punishment due to us upon himself. And so the cross becomes the only possible bridge across the gap. The cross means that we can be forgiven by God. But no one is forced to cross over the bridge to have a relationship with God. And if we want to know God, we must talk to Jesus by praying. We must follow the example of one of the criminals who was crucified next to Jesus. This man acknowledged his guilt and Jesus's innocence. And then he recognized that Jesus, although crucified, was indeed king of a kingdom not of this world. This criminal had nothing to offer Jesus except a plea for mercy. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he heard the Savior King reply, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. So likewise, we must tell Jesus that he is our only hope of spiritual rescue, and we are sorry for our selfishness and pride. And we must tell him that he is indeed our rightful king, and that with his help, we will now serve him. Now, if you have ever sincerely prayed that kind of special prayer, you have entered the kingdom of Jesus. King Jesus, who now reigns in heaven, loves you so much that he gave up his life on the cross for you. Surely that is a king to be trusted with every part of our lives. Let us be silent together for a minute. If you are praying that special prayer for the first time, either here in church or at home, please do tell someone here you know, one of the deacons, the leaders, or phone the church office to get in touch. Please also tell us if you're still at the stage of asking questions. Either way, we would love to hear where you're at and to pray for you. Now let's stand together to sing our closing hymn, Crown Him with Many Crowns.